The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by Lean Agile Intelligence. Optimize the flow of feedback. Find them at www.leanagileintelligence.com.
This is Alistair Coburn. You're listening to Agile Uprising podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am this week's host, Jay Hersko. And unless you've been living under a rock for the last couple weeks or vacationing on some island without internet service, you probably have come across the news that Safe version 4.5 has just been released. So leading into this episode, myself and Andrew Lepp, say hi, Andrew.
Hey, everyone.
We'll be discussing the Safe 4.5 changes and what our interpretation of and what we think about them. And we have a very special guest with us tonight, the quote-unquote godfather of Safe himself, Mr. Dean Leffingwell. So, Dean, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Fantastic. So let's dive right in. So, Dean, can you give us a little bit of insight into the process behind how we go from 4 to 4.5? Like, what was the impetus inside of Scaled Agile for you guys to say, okay, it's time for a revision. It's time to make some changes.
Well, we constantly learn. I mean, the world is evolving. People are building bigger and bigger solutions. You see various, you know, somewhat independent movements that are really helpful. Things like Lean Startup and Lean UX, and now there's DevOps and continuous delivery. There are some things we didn't like about the prior rendering of the framework. We didn't have some of the imaging quite the way we wanted. There was some interpretations that people would look at the framework and just, for example, look at the kind of the gray background between levels and say, oh, it's so hierarchical. And, you know, you get puzzled by that stuff. At the same time, you say, well, I can see why they could see that. So every year or two, and kind of consistent with what I've done throughout my career, we've learned new things and I just feel compelled to record them. So at some point we decided it was time for 4.5. There was no real tipping point other than, you know, the time had come. So we had accumulated a new body of knowledge. We had been in the field for, you know, a year and a half since the 4.0 release. I was real keen on two major threads, which is Lean Startup and DevOps. And while they're somewhat independent schools of thought, you can't do one without the other in the larger enterprise. So when those came together in my mind as basically one sweet spot path, where a small batch size can move from, you know, portfolio or program ideation to fast feedback, it just, for me, it kind of unlocked things and it moved my view of Safe from how to help people reliably deliver larger solutions. And that's what you folks are involved in. And that's one of the things that Safe is good at, to how with such a delivery capability, you could move in the larger enterprise to use that capability to innovate. So those were the major impetuses. Time was an impetus. We do continuous delivery of articles, as you probably know, but we can't change the big picture very often because people tend to freak out. So this whole notion of continuous delivery is more like continuous delivery. And as you see, if you study Safe, it's not a monolith. Our solution isn't a monolith. Other solutions aren't monoliths. So you don't just pick up a large app and rev it with a couple new web services and one new user story and ship the whole thing. It has to be a lot more incremental than that. So those insights, understanding that DevOps has always been in the value stream, are triggering or actually kind of pivoting to using the value stream as a fundamental organizational concept. Those all came together. It just wells all up and says, okay, it's time.
So real quick, Dean, thanks for that. I had a sort of, you hit on something that I wanted to further elaborate on. You talked about, you know, getting more involved in Lean, not that Safe isn't Lean, you know, built off of the house of Lean. But that being said, I did notice that you guys now have a almost like a value stream canvas.
We do. It's very close to that. We have, it is a value stream canvas, and it is somewhat kind of lean business canvas like, but it's not an entire business strategy document. It's a reflection of, okay, for this particular value stream, how is it structured? What are the solutions that it entails? Who are the key stakeholders? And I forget some of the other elements on that. So that's just another place where inspiration leads to, reflection, integration, and in some cases, simplification. So there's so many tools in the market that we have. And if we stacked up the books that have influenced SAFE, it's hundreds of books tall. And our job, I've always viewed my job as more of a system integrator to understand how these things can fit together and to attempt to create kind of a consistent integral semantic model where you could talk about an initiative with a word. You could talk about, an MVP, have it make sense. You can talk about minimum marketable features and features themselves. You can talk about user stories and have the whole thing make sense. So that's what I'm trying to do is to make sense out of these incredibly diverse and powerful bodies of knowledge. And that's a synthesis of what SAFE is. There's so much, I kind of grew up in lean. I got, pivoted to agile when everybody else did. I did iterative and incremental development for the decade before that. We have a really rich environment, but you can't go to an average, VP of dev or CIO or practitioner and say, please read these 100 books and synthesize your own framework. So we took that on ourselves. We decided to make that, freely revealed and publicly facing so that everybody could share that knowledge. And that was our initial mission. The initial mission was, interestingly enough, not particularly commercial. That was not the goal of me or the enterprise.
Yeah, that's great. I was so happy to see the whole canvas strategy part of SAFE because it's something I use, as an SPC. I sort of try and incorporate that. So that's some feedback for you. I was really pleased to see this part of it. So nice work.
I appreciate that. And I think we often, underestimate the value of simple thinking tools. And when you incorporate a simple thinking tool like that, for example, the lean business case, the art canvas, the value stream canvas, it gives you a way to organize your thoughts and communicate in a common way. So it doesn't have to be a rocket science invention to have value. A checklist for getting ready for PI planning, a standard agenda, a way to think about running inspect and adapt. None of these are, standalone brilliant insights, and I don't care. What they are is awesome tools that, if properly used and integrated, can help create better outcomes.
That's a great point.
Awesome. So if you don't mind, gents, let's dive into some of the changes to 4.5. First thing I think we should cover off is what I think is one of the bigger and more impressive ones is the approach to SAFE where we have different configurations. We have essential SAFE, we have large solution, and up to portfolio. So Dean, not to throw it back to you again, but can you give us a little bit of backstory before Lef and I start trading insights and our take on that whole thing?
You bet. Well, for starters, 5-6 years ago, it didn't have to be configurable because there wasn't much there, right? So when I started down this path about 8 or 9 years ago, I was really enamored by Agile development. I became part of an Agile team. I loved it. I coached Agile teams. I had the epiphany that I never again, didn't want to be on an Agile team. So how do you get a lot of Agile teams to cooperate? Well, you have to have some vision, some strategy, maybe a common backlog, some architectural underpinnings, common cadence and synchronization, points at which it's relatively easy to make sure that you do synchronize and, if necessary, force synchronization. So it's really kind of a program level thing, teams of teams. And then we added some stuff about portfolio to say, well, how do you think about larger initiatives? Not everything's a feature. What if we wanted to, enter a new market? So we added the portfolio and then that grew. And then we were triggered for this large solutions layer, which we unfortunately kind of mislabeled the large value stream layer for, in version 4, by larger enterprises that came to us, including folks that you know and work with directly, I won't mention their names, and said, this is great, but frankly, we have hundreds of teams and they need to cooperate to help, to help provide a more integrated solution. So we added the value stream level, which has now been appropriately renamed the large solution level. And by the way, it was the large value stream level. Then we dropped the large and then we lost kind of the whole, the whole the whole insight there, because all of a sudden we had a value stream level and we had value streams. And then as SAFE grew, of course, it got bigger and people started wondering, well, do I have to do this whole thing? It was a bit of an eye chart. It got intimidating. And the next issue became, well, how much of this did we have to do? And then we went through another kind of series of just learnings in the market that said, well, you know, some of this stuff is essential. And that causes us to go back to first principles, which is, you know, the original kind of constructs behind SAFE, the Agile Release Trainer program level. As you look at the big picture of full SAFE and even version 4, I've had more than one kind of CIO saying, I don't know if we can do all of that. Well, dang, if it's that intimidating to start, we've kind of blown it. So at one point we were in class talking about extensibility and configurability, and one of the students in class did, I don't remember, it was cut and paste or just a little fold up. He said, it needs to work like this. You need to be able to configure it for your needs. And that triggered the thought for configurability. Then we had the essential SAFE thread. We had to incorporate that directly. And, you know, the net result of that is a lot of ideation and 100 drawings away. Now you can kind of click and say, you know, we need the whole thing. We just want essential SAFE. Large solution SAFE is a configuration that we hadn't envisioned. The market taught us that. They said, we're involved in a big program, this portfolio stuff and CapEx and OpEx and budget. Frankly, that's not our concern. So having that there isn't helpful. And in some cases, they said it was, frankly, negative to have those considerations be part of, you know, a part of the persona or the style of that project. So it became compellingly obvious in hindsight. And then it took, you know, maybe close to 6 months to a year to figure out how to merge, you know, those large solutions level, how to collapse that and keeping the semantics right so that you can make the large solution level go away and have SAFE still work. That's a non-trivial feat, you know. You can operate without capabilities. You don't really need them unless you're building a large solution. So it's not one thing. It's more of an aggregation of some degree of complexity, some degree of the need for configurability, some discoveries that people are saying, well, it's just a big framework. So we use it, but we didn't train the teams in Agile. I'm like, what? It's a big framework and we're really struggling. And you say, well, how's the solution demo going? Well, we don't do that because it's a framework and we don't do the solution demo. Or you had this issue. Didn't that come up in Expect and Adapt? It's hard to get everybody together for that. So we don't have that meeting. So it became our obligation to tell people, look, you got to do some things well to make SAFE work. And the rest you can configure as you need to over time.
So Andrew, when you first saw it, what were your thoughts? Like, where do you see this fitting in your not only day to day, but your professional experience?
No, I mean, I really like the fact that it breaks down and is much more configurable in a sense now. So you can sort of almost have those different placemats. It helps sort of illustrate and scale, for lack of a better word, sort of what instance you're really looking to do to capture truly the essence. And to me, it's makes it a little easier and for me to go in and implement and work with an organization to pretty much frame up what that would look like based upon whatever slice we're going to use.
I do concur with that. When I first saw it, I was bowled over, but for the reason of mainly when it comes to implementation, right? Because my last two SAFE implementations I've been involved in has been in large enterprise type companies. They do have suppliers. They do have that sort of relationship, multiple value streams and whatnot. And when you drop that big picture on people, usually, like Dean, like you said, they get a little overwhelmed, right? The fact that it's almost there's some stratigraphy involved where I would then say, okay, well, look at the team and the program level. That's where we start. Let's get good at doing those pieces. And because that's more of the agile adoption versus transformation. It's the mechanics. Let's get really good at that. And while you have the teams getting good at the mechanics, I would then say, okay, well, now let me go up two steps on the totem pole. Let's start talking about the large solution and the portfolio pieces. Let's talk about how we get our executives and the greater company at large involved in this adoption and get them thinking along the same path. So it's sort of like, and I know we're going to get to the implementation roadmap later, but it sort of helped it. I conceptually said, well, that helps me step everyone through. Let's do this. Let's start crawling, and then we'll start walking, and then we'll start running. And that's where I think the beauty of it all comes together.
One of the guys on the team, Richard Naster, was fooling around over the holidays, and he turned the tool palette sideways, and it solved a host of issues. And as soon as he did that, we said, oh, that makes so much sense, because I want to inherit these things, right? Think I'm object-oriented. I might want to inherit a vision for the portfolio, the large solution, or the art, or the team level. And as soon as you put that tool palette to the side, you get this kind of metaphorical notion of dragging and dropping and say, yeah, we need milestones here because we're given them by our customer. Or actually, no, we don't need milestones. It's not a concern. We can keep them implicit. So it was actually a two-part move. One was to figure out how to do the expand collapse. And secondly, to get the tool palette out of the way and let it float in such a way that it didn't interfere with that. And in so doing, that really kind of doubly expresses the configurability. You can expand and collapse and then say, you know, we need a vision. We need a roadmap. Lean UX doesn't really apply to me. No, we really need that, right? That's, you know, we're very heavy user facing. So that gave us kind of two dimensions of configurability. And I think that really unlocks people from, you know, the fear factor of A, can it be configured? It's obvious it can. And B, where do I start? We'll start with Essential Safe. In addition, large enterprises such as where you guys work, they're not homogenous. So you might need everything that Safe has, but you don't need it in every division or every business unit or every application. So it's not as if an enterprise says, oh, we use full Safe or we use large solution Safe. They use various pieces throughout the enterprise. And indeed, they'll use multiple instances of Safe because not all solutions are driven from a single budget. So those two dimensions of configurability help immensely. They eliminate some of the retina burn, they eliminate some of the fear. And I think they eliminate some of the objections as, wow, that's a big heavyweight framework. Well, there's a lot of stuff in there. So is that heavyweight? Well, it's designed for building big solutions. Call it what you like.
Right. It's sort of at an enterprise level, it sort of needs to be. And speaking of the enterprise level, so the next question we want to come up is compliance, right? I actually sit next to a compliance guy at my office. So he was really stoked that he saw this called out in the new picture. So obviously we always put risk, governance, and compliance. Risk, compliance, and governance are always the same three things sort of lumped together. I think actually the chapter in Lean Enterprise does lump those three together. Can you give us a little insight into what led to, hey, maybe we should throw the compliance wrench into the works now?
Yeah, and we don't see them as the same thing, and that's why they're kind of called out differently. So the compliance starts out with a slightly separate thread, and that is that my personal background for the first kind of 20 years of my career, even more like 30, was building high assurance systems, you know, systems that went bump in the night, people that were man rated, fun stuff like, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom ride, which could hurt people if it goes off track. And then really serious products like, microprocessor based ventilators for home use. So we've had this kind of high assurance thread that we worked off and on for the last 4 or 5 years, and we've had white papers and guidance articles. When you talk about high assurance, people don't resonate with the word very well. And they also, we hit another factor, which is, okay, well, we'd like to use Safe, but we've got Sarbanes-Oxley. We'd like to use Safe, but we have the FDA. And they tend to capitulate to their existing quality management system, which is based upon the waterfall, because that's what we taught them 20 years ago. So that's a really naughty thing to unravel. And we've unraveled it initially in a parallel path. We'll have a white paper soon. You can read the compliance article that tells you exactly where we're going. Sticking compliance on the big picture was for exactly the reason you mentioned. It's an important comfort factor that says these guys get this. Now, with respect to risk management, audit, and compliance, these are complex topics. We had one of our larger adopters called the other day and needed some help. And they said, we're having trouble. You know, we don't know how to audit with Safe and Agile. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, we have audit functions and we don't know how to do that now. So we started breaking that out. And we said, well, what are you auditing for? And he said, well, one of the things we're auditing for is stuff like Sarbanes-Oxley. Well, that's one type of thing. A Sarbanes-Oxley audit is in part related to the functionality of the system. Others are like, well, we're audited for following our quality management system in terms of how we build the product because we work with the FDA under design controls. And then another part has said, well, we need to audit as to whether our spend is working right or not. So these words they're as overloaded as team, right, or as agile is. So right. We have to tease them apart. So we move from kind of thinking about high assurance to moving to building systems that require compliance. And then we've created this IP stack that is only now partially integrated and Safe to kind of give you a hint of where we're headed. that basically says, well, let's look at compliance as one activity. But if we look at risk management and governance, we see that as a different one. So governance is handled primarily through the newly relabeled, you know, lean portfolio management function, where we describe what lean governance is. Compliance is triggered from the standpoint of this article shows you how to evolve your QMS system to do compliance iterative incrementally. And then the risk part is really mitigated. Risk is like a watermark, right? You mitigate risk by knowing you're building the right thing and getting feedback that the thing is actually working. So I would say that a PI and a system demo are some of the largest risk mitigation items you can use. So whether you've identified risks on a spreadsheet or not, or you've got a PMI strategy that says we've identified them all, if you're delivering systems incrementally and you're getting feedback, you're largely mitigating risk. So these are all of these, as you well know, are not trivial topics, and we don't apologize for that. But part of our job is to help tease that apart and create surfaces where you can talk about things. So right now in the compliance surface, we're going to talk about how you achieve compliance. And that has to be both to process as well as product, because some of compliance is functional. I'm building an automobile and the braking standard has to be this. Some of compliance is thou shalt have an SRS. Those are unlike things. So if people are going to depend upon us to help them guide them, you know, into the future with Agile, we can't treat those as the same thing because they're not. So your quality management system has to recognize that some things become functional requirements, some become non-functional requirements, and some, frankly, are design constraints on your process. And we have that depth and background and experience. The trick is to be able to express that without making a 5-page big picture and a 5,000-page framework.
True. Now, Andrew, I know you and I have been in some of the same trenches. SOX compliance, the compliance guys, InfoSec, they always find a way to rear their heads into what we're doing. What were your thoughts looking at this? And do you see this? I mean, I know what you're doing currently. I don't want to talk about current employers, but is this make your life easier, harder? What are your thoughts?
No, I think it can help make it easier. I think a lot of the compliance issues that I've encountered really fall outside of any framework or methodology. It's just, you know, how do you incorporate a silo and get them part of the team as opposed to actually just, you know, waiting to get information and then overruling on it. So it's really just creating sort of that balance. So from what I'm understanding, and I'm still digging into all the 4.5 material, but it seems like it will be helpful in trying to build that bridge.
I personally think the compliance guys are just happy to see that they got a nod, right?
And I think, Andrew, with respect to what you're describing, it may be true that a lot of those activities operate outside the framework, but if they're based upon waterfall development methods, now you're really in a box because they're operating with a different way of working paradigm than we're delivering to. So that's why we can't just ignore the issue and say compliance is still compliance and it operates outside the world, because we don't build necessarily the types of artifacts that our traditional compliance and quality management systems drive. And we have to have replacements for those artifacts. A good example is a software requirement specification. If you're building a product for the FDA in the US, you're going to have one. It's in the federal code, okay? So if you don't have one, you're violating the federal law. So you're not going to sit there and say, we throw away our user stories and just read the test cases. You're going to create a requirement specification, but it doesn't say you have to do it up front. It just says you have to have one that you can validate to before you release your device to be used on a patient. So if you take the fact that you have to have an SRS as a given, which you do in that world, and you then use that to conflate that with your traditional view of development, now I'm doing the SRS up front because I have to have one. And therein lies, you know, the big pitfall. That's where you fall in a giant hole where you're arguing with your compliance guys because they're saying you don't use SRSs and the FDA says you're gonna, or I'm going to jail. That's serious work. And we've always considered it part of our charter to help sort that out, to help people understand that compliance is compliance and it's critical, but that's not the same as your development method.
Right. Perfect. Well said. I gotta write that down. I'm gonna use that again. I'm gonna quote the guy who created Safe. Next topic we wanted to cover off, which actually the question this came to from a coworker of mine was Agile architecture. Yeah. You know, architecture in enterprise environments is always one of those third party sort of groups that they always seem to swoop in, and they have all these great ideas, some good, giant ideas, some good, some bad. And I actually had a coworker say to me, you know, how come it moved off the big picture and off to the side? He said, is it really being treated like an afterthought, or, which was his knee jerk reaction. So Dean, can you give us some insight on that one?
Well, number one, I really appreciate the question. Okay. I'm glad people notice these things. Now let me tell you the story about Agile architecture. We actually had three representations. Actually, in version four, we had four representations for architecture. We had architecture evolves continuously. It's just kind of a little slogan. We had Agile architecture. We had architectural runway. When we moved into version four, we associated the Agile architecture specifically with a larger system. We associate it with solution intent because the architecture is reflected typically as part of solution intent. When we added compliance, we had a decision to make. Do we want to put another one up there, or does the notion of architectural runway, which admittedly is relegated physically to the art layer, and built-in quality, which pivots to Agile architecture, is that enough? And we just made kind of a conscious decision that said, I think it's enough. Architecture is still absolutely there. I will also tell you that, you know, I'm a bit of a techie. I mean, it's been decades since I've written any code, but I still care about that stuff. You could call me a bit architecture-centric. But I'll also tell you that for example, we do SBC trainings, and some of you have been through that. And we put up open space topics, and we often put up Agile architecture. Nobody ever votes for it. So there's a very small number of people who care about that a lot. And there's a very large number of people who think that's some weird techie gobbledygook. So it was just one of those little trade-offs. It says if we put compliance there, we still have Agile architecture. The article is still there. You can get to it from architectural runway or from quality. And it was just a decision that said you can't put absolutely everything on the big picture. And over the years, we put a lot of stuff on that eventually leaves. Architecture didn't leave. Architectural runway is a serious topic. And it kind of like a floating tool palette icon, it applies everywhere. But we chose to describe it there because if your team of teams doesn't have some kind of intentionality of architecture good for 3 or 6 months, they're going to fail to meet their deliveries because they're going to just have to rototill the entire architecture every third sprint. So that's not really a defense. It's an explanation of why it did move and why compliance took its place.
Awesome. And I'm definitely going to send this podcast to the guy who asked me the question and say, hey, does this answer your question? Because if not, now I have Dean's email address. We can always pester him from the office.
Absolutely. And we have the enterprise architect up there to one of your bullets. And, you know, we live in an interesting world. We are a leader in the market. Leaders get arrows in their back, and that's great. Everybody wants to shoot at the leaders. We live in an agile world. I like to think of myself as a very agile person. And yet I'm not a fundamentalist. And we've had reactions the opposite too, which is, oh, architecture, intentionality, an enterprise architect. You can't be agile if you have an enterprise architect. Well, excuse me. You can't really evolve solutions in an agile manner if you don't have an enterprise architectural strategy. And yet we don't want to create easy, you know, easy talking points for critics. We also want to defend what needs to be defended. So enterprise architecture, architectural runway, those are still prime citizens. It's just that we didn't have to have the Agile architecture budget, Agile architecture icon button on the BP. And, you know, everything we do is a compromise here. One of the rules we made 6 years ago is you only get one page. It has to be 8.5 by 11. So if that's your design constraint, man, there's a lot of debates about what you put on that 8.5 by 11 sheet.
No, that's great. I mean, I totally agree. And having dealt with many of architects, it's always an interesting conversation. So it's nice to see that sort of illustrated in this way now.
Cool.
So, you know, as we keep sort of rolling through this, one piece that really jumped out at me that I would love to hear some more insight on and maybe how this sort of was the genesis going into this was, you know, around the lean UX mm-hmm. part of it. I deal with a lot of mobile and .com spaces, and this is always a challenge, yep. especially with the organizations that I've dealt with. So I actually love the fact that you call this out this way now and sort of have even this diagram around the feature, evaluate, outcome, collaborative, and build. So I would love to hear some more insight on that.
Well, so I'm a fan of all things lean. And I'll also tell you that my interest was tweaked and piqued by a customer 4 years ago who said that, and it was early times for SAFE, but they were a very advanced thinking customer. And they said, we really like SAFE. We're adopting SAFE and we're adopting Lean Startup. So we passed your Agile Software Requirements book around and Lean Startup book around, and we're using SAFE for delivery and Lean Startup for our thinking. Well, honestly, it hurt my feelings a little bit because it's like, well, that SAFE is relegated to just producing stuff you've already figured out. And of course, if as you understand the Agile paradigm, wow, you can't actually be a very lean startup if you can't deliver from an agile manner. So I followed all of those movements. I read the books, and I'm jumping forward one notion, talk about DevOps a little bit as well. So if you step back a second and say, what does lean startup mean? It means you have to have the ability to innovate by getting fast feedback. That means you have to have a smaller batch size, right? You can't get fast feedback on a 2-year development effort. You have to do the first 2 months. It ties directly in the lean budget. So when I kind of reconsidered SAFE, I think beyond the basic blocking and tackling, do we have the roles described? Are the responsibilities? Is it a full system? And said, now, how could I use that? The lean startup and lean UX and DevOps, they fit like a glove. It's like the Nike swoosh right through the middle of this thing, you know, a watermark that goes right through and says, I can innovate at the portfolio by defining a minimum viable product. I'm going to bust that up into 10 features. Well, guess what? Each of those features is suspect. I don't know if those are good features. So what did Lean UX teach us? It taught us a number of things. It taught us that the UX is not about pixel perfect designs. It taught us that UX is not an isolated silo. It taught us that teams implement UX, not siloed individuals. It taught us that if you call that thing a hypothesis, then nobody gets their feelings hurt when it doesn't work, right? When an experiment fails, you don't get your feeling hurt. You go, well, I learned from that experiment. So the notion of, you know, the scientific method of designing a small experiment, getting feedback and adapting, it's throughout SAFE. So while these, I don't think any one person has ever attended, you know, Lean Startup, Lean UX, a DevOps, and a SAFE conference, if you will, they're parts of the same continuum of thinking. So for me, pivoting from UX to Lean UX was natural with the Lean Startup, which we relegated largely to the larger initiatives, right? If you want to read about Lean Startup, you'll go find it at the portfolio and epic level. And then that leads into DevOps, because if I can't deploy this stuff, I can't get feedback. So while it seems like, you know, buzzword soup, maybe it's like we follow the hype cycle and we take a word and we stick it in SAFE. That's the way I would make fun of it if I wanted to. The reality is behind those buzzwords are some really meaningful new methods and new thinking. So, you know, lean startup, a portfolio that does budgets from a lean fashion so you don't have to allocate the full amount. The ability to try something and have it fail and not get fired, right? That's a project, but project-based funding. If you talk to companies that do project-based funding, you ask a question, is it okay if projects fail? They say no. And you ask another question, well, tell me how you innovate. So I see this as all one thing, frankly. I see a holistic view that says, okay, projects is a bad word. We don't want projects to fail. But I could create a feature and create a feature hypothesis. And by simply using that word, I've triggered back to the scientific method. It's no longer assumption-driven development. I'm not going to say that this epic is guaranteed to produce the following results. And the use of the word hypothesis is incredibly powerful. I've worked with some folks, you know, only recently, because it's only recently we've integrated it. And I talked to a CEO of one of the, you know, large cable company, CIO, sorry. And he was basically saying, you know, I don't really care what framework teams use as long as I know exactly what I'm going to get, what it's going to cost, and what the ROI is. And that, you know what that thinking is, right? That's a trap. So I said, let's talk some more about that before we talk about the framework. And I said, name an initiative. And he named one. I said, what's the hypothesis of that? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what do you think will happen when you execute that? Well, this and this will happen. And then I ask another question. What's the minimum you would have to spend to prove that? And he goes, well, and how would you prove it without investing the whole amount? Now he's thinking, right? He's thinking on his feet. He's going, well, we probably wouldn't have to do it all. We could probably just, you know, roll out to a specific market. This is a, I'm not sure how to describe it. This is a great new surface to change the discussion about how you do innovation and how you avoid the pitfalls of fixed price, fixed scope, waterfall projects without saying Agile is cool, your waterfall dog doesn't hunt anymore, and you guys suck when you think old like that. So it's a great way to get everybody to think about what's the hypothesis behind this investment, how do we need to spend, and how do we get fast feedback? And that's going to lead naturally into one of the next big issues, which is how do you do that without continuous delivery or the ability to move a small batch size move into production?
Now, it's so funny. I love to hear that because literally having dealing with a few of our UX folks, it's been always pixel perfect. We got to go out and test market and do, you know, these beautiful prototypes, and creates a lot of waste. So I'm going to actually play that in one of, you know, replay what you just said in some of my coaching sessions. So that's phenomenal.
Try not to annoy them too much. Try to enjoin them in a process to say, hey, none of us know how this is going to work and we need a great UX. And let's work together to implement that. And that certainly includes good user design.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Although I like annoying them. Sometimes that can be fun too.
Yeah, I know. I do too sometimes, but I can't do it in any official forum. I can only do that in my private forums.
So we're gonna skip ahead here. One of the other things that I felt was fantastic that we'd like to touch on is the implementation roadmap, right? And for those of you that haven't seen the diagram, it's a logical, it almost looks like the game of life, only it's not the game of life, it's the game of safe, right? Yeah. And it's how to go from I want to go safe to I am doing safe and I'm actually incrementally improving. I'm going through iterations. So I'm assuming, Dean, that the birth of this idea was coming from, as you were speaking to people who were actually doing safe and using safe, I'm assuming maybe you got some feedback that they were having tough getting over a certain hump. Was it everybody hitting the same hang up?
Or? They were hitting different hang ups at different times and didn't know where to start, right? So it's like, okay, we want to build an Agile portfolio, but we don't have Agile teams yet. So how do I do that? We need to inculcate a lean and agile mindset. Manifesto matters. As you know, we teach that. We teach the manifesto right up front within the first 2 hours of the Leading Safe course. You're learning about the Agile manifesto. So we needed those mindsets. And that means that we need to have the executives engaged. You need to have a reason to change. You need to understand what an art and a value stream is. Those are really abstract terms. You need to figure out where you have pull. Who wants to implement first? Where's the first art go? And then it's like, okay, how would we organize the teams? And we want to organize them for, you know, feature-based delivery and independent releasability. So I would say that the implementation roadmap is late to the party for a couple reasons. One is the patterns hadn't really emerged and there is no one right way, just like, you know. And two is we had bigger fish to fry because until we could really make safe work to the point where we could say, no, this thing really works good now, then the implementation roadmap was simply second tier. But a year and a half ago, that hit critical mass. And as people were rolling out more and more, they asked the question, well, we know there's more than one way, but would you give us one way? And we stepped back, and that actually introduces one of the other questions that I think you're going to ask about. Is it prescriptive? Well, it works to implement that way. Do you have to do it that way? No, but it just kind of works. So I was primarily the author of that thread, and I did it over a 6-month period, and I did that as a series of incremental delivery articles and got feedback from that. And I think I'm not sure if I'm surprised, but I'm certainly pleased by the value that has. What's the balancing act? Do you have to implement that way? No. Okay, let's skip a step. Like, let's not train our leaders. How's that going to work?
Yeah, that sounds like a recipe for success.
Let's not create agile teams, or let's not train the teams. So, you know, you got to do that stuff. Do you have to do it in exactly that order? No. And it also triggers into, to be honest, it triggers into our commercial model. We didn't start out as a commercial enterprise. That was not the goal. However, we make a living at this. We employ a lot of people, and our partners employ a lot of people. And the reality is, without effective training, you're not going to be successful with SAFE. So what is our economic model? It's very simple. Our IP is free. The courseware, we charge for that. So it ties nicely into getting people trained, and there is a direct correlation between whether people have been trained and whether they're successful. And that's not just for SAFE, that's for every dang organizational change of any type you could ever imagine. And I think if you read Cotter or Heath and Heath, we often wave a flag and say, here's a big change. We need to be ISO compliant, or, you know, we're going to introduce this new product and we need to, you know, it needs to be a pre-market approval. Go do it. Well, you got to train people. So we're not shy about the fact that you got to be trained to do about that. I'm not shy about the fact that you need to be trained to be effective. We're not shy about the fact that we are a commercial enterprise. That's what keeps the heat, power, and lights on. That's what keeps the SAFE website up, is the fact that we're able to make a living, fostering this method and delivering this method, the IP for free, and the courseware not quite so free.
Right. I mean, you should. I think it would be completely unrealistic for everyone to expect you to work everything pro bono. That just doesn't. It doesn't work in real life. It's like communism. It's great in theory. It's great in academic application. But if you try and do it in real life, you have Venezuela.
And we all have our philanthropic efforts. And we think that we provide a lot of value for free in the framework. You don't have to hire us or as our partner to use it. At the same time, it's fun to make a living. And that's the way we can grow the business and really promulgate SAFE and help people. I mean, you're on the phone here with us, or I'm on this podcast, because SAFE helps deliver better outcomes. And that can be as simple as, wow, we reduce the time to market on our game. Or it can be where I was, you know, a few weeks back, where a company is saying, you know, with better IT systems, we could reduce the hospitalization due to chemotherapy. That's meaningful work. That's the type of thing that gets you up and says, wow, if we can help people do that, we're really improving outcomes and lives. And we might make fun of our commercialism, or, you know, the fact that people tend to get method inclined or whatever. But the reality is, better systems make people's lives better. And that's what I've been working on for, you know, 40 some years. SAFE is just my latest instance of trying to improve lives.
And Andrew, I know you're probably still swooning because Dean mentioned Cotter. Dean Andrew has a giant crush on John Cotter and that whole book.
I'm going to share that.
He's quoted at me. We've had a couple of interesting discussions where he's quoted it to me ad nauseum. So let me ask you this, Andrew, as the SBC that's on the phone, it's on the podcast, looking at the implementation roadmap, do you think how helpful does this change your approach at all, I guess would be my question, in your current endeavors? Does this make you sort of retool your thinking, or does it give you just another argument to say, here's why we need to do it this way?
No, I think it actually supports my approach. My approach sometimes was a little challenging with some of the materials at some stages, and it could have just been where the company was, or, you know, part of their adoption, or, you know, sort of meeting the client where they are. But this really supports it in a much better way. And like you said, I mean, I constantly go into every transformation, and Cotter is pretty much how I frame up, you know, sort of that transformation. So this all really sort of plays really nice in a different way for me now, just going in and really being able to, again, sort of having those vertical slices and be able to showcase things in a different way. And, you know, selfishly enough, again, you know, that lean UX and DevOps piece is really going to help me, because that was a place I was struggling in my current engagement. So this is going to be nice to sort of not force feed them, but really kind of walk them along the way.
And you certainly recognize the Cotter overlay in the implementation roadmap, right?
Yes.
It wasn't until it was probably 2 years or so ago that I got my mind around that and started seeing, I would say, a programmatic way to address change. And kind of understanding that and kind of researching and doing that research, and then thinking about what we had been doing. I mean, as independent consultants, even pre-SAFE, we were engaged in helping people with burning platforms or proactive people. And we had to always have a sufficiently powerful coalition for change. We had to communicate the vision for change. We had to create the wins. So I think he did an amazingly good job of synthesizing, you know, the steps involved in organizational change. And we just, you know, parroted that on the roadmap.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many companies are challenged with just even those 8 steps.
Yep.
And really trying to get them, even just the vision part of it, you know, it that's outside of any framework or methodology. You know, what's the vision? And it can't be to be innovative, right? I mean, truly, what are you marching towards?
Yep.
Okay.
That's great stuff.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I know we're quickly running out of time. So I do want to hit on the last question that we came up with, which is obviously this is the one that comes from the Twitter trolls and the people who are obviously keyboard tough guys. And it's around the including the role of the SPC inside of the SAFE foundation, the SAFE substrate. And obviously you're going to have someone who's going to complain and say, well, this is just a money grab. And it sort of ties to your remark on, you know, it wasn't, you offer your IP for free, but then the training and all that stuff is a requisite add-on, right? So at what point did you go, huh, we really need to have an SPC a part of this to hopefully guarantee success?
It was when I did the implementation roadmap and when we started assessing what success looked like in these companies and looked at their patterns. And we always see in a successful large enterprise lots of SPCs at work. And by the way, you know, it's not a job, it's just a role, right? So that might be a system architect, it might be a change management person, it might be somebody's been a scrum master, it might be a program manager or whatever. And I would reflect the question back to you guys now that you have some experience. Can you envision success without a number of SPCs?
I cannot know. Having worked within a couple SAFE environments that have, you know, people that have organically done it, no, I definitely see the value in an SPC.
So that's why we put it in there. Are there commercial benefits? Sure. Do I feel the need to apologize? Not a bit.
Love it.
Yeah, I concur. I think you could, if you tried to do it without an SPC, it'd be like most things where you get to a certain point where it just stalls and you need that expert in the room, like, right?
We're using Scrum, but we don't have any Scrum Masters. Uh-huh.
What was there was a quote, I think it was by Andy Hunt. It was one of the manifesto guys we interviewed who said, like, everybody uses Jira. Half of us do Scrum, and we all do it poorly, or something to that effect.
Well, if you wanted to have fun with those arguments, to look a little bit, you could look at the Scrum Master and say, "Well, wait a minute, is that a commercial thing?" You tell me.
That's a great argument, and you know, similar. I like how you evolve the role of the RTE.
Yes.
You know, you sort of change the name, which to me sort of lends itself a little bit better. Sort of resonates a little bit easier with sort of that role, you know, being the solution train engineer as opposed to the release train engineer.
Yeah, that was you know, if you play around in the methodology space, every word you want to use is overloaded. So, you know, and every program manager thinks they're an agile program manager. So RTE is one of those places where we just invented a term because we wanted to put our own meaning with it. And we wanted to associate a far more facilitative and agile and indeed servant leadership part of that role. And yet I think, you know, some good RTEs, I'll bet you do. And I'll bet you they're pretty strong people. You know, those are boys and girls that have some hard bark on them, but they understand that their best success is working through others. So we wanted to kind of program that behavior into that critical role. And we wanted to separate that from the what gets built, right? When you conflate what and how, there are some advantages because it's all one vision. At the same time, there are disadvantages because if you can't figure out the how, then that changes your mind on the what. So that was one of the places that I think we picked a term, put meaning around it. I mean, you know, they're not engineers, so you can make fun of it if you want, but so what? It's a term that has value, and we've been able to use it to ascribe certain behaviors that are effective and frankly necessary. Without even asking, I can guarantee you that the successful SAFE programs that you see have capable RTEs on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's having coached a few RTEs now from the ground up, it's a tough job. I mean, no ifs, ands, or buts. It's a really hard job, especially when you're dealing with a large train. So it's a really tough spot. So it's nice to see that you guys have sort of broken out a separate training for that as well, mm-hmm. as sort of created this path. So I think that will really help the enablement of better quality in the RTE or I guess STE space.
Yep. We agree. And that's, you know, if you think about the people side of SAFE, it's a set of responsibilities. They're roles, not titles. The title is less relevant. I mean, we often go through an exercise of taking your business card and throw it on the table and then shove it off the table. Now figure out what you're going to do on this program. So the people side of SAFE is an integrated set of responsibilities. And it doesn't matter so much who does them. We have to associate responsibilities with roles. So the engineering of the social network that's behind SAFE comes with the fact that, say, gosh, somebody's got to have responsibility for the program backlog. It can't be a committee. On the other hand, if it's an oligarch, that doesn't work either, because you're not going to build a system that meets the needs of the stakeholders. So each of these principles, you kind of abstract back and say, what do we need to be effective there? Who needs, what things need to be done for the system to work? And that aggregate set of responsibilities really is the people side of SAFE.
Yeah. That's music to my ears. Absolutely.
Perfect. And with that, gentlemen, I think we're just about out of time. So Dean, anything you want to plug, any shout outs you want to give, anything as we wrap this one up?
No, I appreciate the questions and the insights and the challenges. I think it shows that we're all perhaps at a different degree of maturity than we were 4 or 5 years ago, and that we can maybe demystify and argue a little less and agree a little more and move forward with helping people build better systems.
Awesome. Thank you very much. On behalf of myself, on behalf of Andrew and all of our listeners, we really thank you, Dean, for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Out of your busy day to sit with us. I think this has been a really insightful conversation. I took a whole bunch of notes, especially I got to look up how to use inculcate in a sentence, because I haven't heard that word.
Deprogramming me for all that. I'm supposed to use only sentences that could, words that could be understood in at least 4 languages. That's not one of them.
Well, again, on behalf of the Uprising, I want to thank you, Dean, for your time. Thanks. And again, we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and we will speak to you again soon.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Lean Agile Intelligence is the industry's first customizable agile assessment and learning platform. The platform's assessment builder, consisting of over 100 agile and lean practices, derived directly from the framework literature, enables organizations to tailor team, program, or leadership assessments to their unique needs. Lean Agile Intelligence facilitates the assessment and provides rolled-up team results in an actionable format so that organization constraints and coaching needs can be identified. The first 4 months are free, so you can determine if this is a platform that adds value to your change initiative. There is no certification required to use Lean Agile Intelligence. The only requirement is an environment of safety that promotes learning and experimentation. Visit us at www.leanagileintelligence.com today.